With the Christian Church apparently absorbed with its own internal battles, life for those outside its influence in Alexandria may have seemed little changed. Indeed, on the surface, the city was still an eclectic centre of learning. Christians found enlightenment at the catechetical schools, Jewish philosophy was taught at the rabbinical school, and the museum and library, whatever the predations of previous centuries, were still filled with scholars. Among this last group, around the middle of the century, lived a little-known member of the museum whose family was also about to have a profound effect on both the life of the city and the fortunes of the world beyond. Theon first appears in the record as an astronomer and mathematician, who in 364 was credited with correctly predicting eclipses of both the sun and the moon. He was in many ways the archetypal member of the museum of this era, a local scholar who never left his city and whose epithets, Egyptos and Alexandrius, suggest that he traced his lineage back through both Greek and Egyptian roots. Because some of his writings survive, we know something of his passions and can gain one of our last glimpses of the great library at work. Theon studied in the Alexandrian way, building his own work around the creation of new editions of the great books in the library and preparing his own commentaries on them. He produced editions of Euclid's Elements, Data, and Optics, and wrote commentaries on Claudius Ptolemy's Almagest and Handy Tables. But Theon also had philosophical interests that were very much of his own time. Amid the bitter recriminations of the Arian heresy, it might seem that Christianity was already the only religion in town, and that faith had been reduced to a matter of which Christian interpretation one chose to follow. This was not the case, however, and the uncertainty of their modern world encouraged even some of the philosophers of the museum to seek answers beyond logic in the more mystical aspects of Neoplatonism. In this religiously charged atmosphere, Theon had taken an interest in divination. In this city of soothsayers and priests, he looked for divine truths in the books of the library and the circling of the stars. The chronicler, Melellus, tells us that he wrote commentaries on the books of the legendary father of alchemy, Hermes Trismegistus, and the mystical Orphic oracles. He is also said to have written a work entitled On Signs and the Examination of Birds and the Croaking of Ravens, as well as treatises on the function of the star Sirius and the influence of the planetary spheres on the Nile River. These may seem like unusual departures for a man who spent his days studying the very down-to-earth geometry of Euclid. But although Theon was at one level a scientist by any modern definition, in his eyes the world was a magical place, filled with omens and hints of the Platonic forms that lay beneath the veneer of reality. For him, to study the heavens was to study the minds of the gods, from which might be deduced not only the physical operation of the world, but clues to the future of individuals and nations. These thoughts found expression in poems attributed to him on astrological themes, one of which survives in the Corpus Hermeticum, a collection of texts of secret wisdom compiled during the Renaissance from various classical materials. In this, Theon speaks of the seven sparkling spheres of heaven, and how their interaction determines the lives of everyone on earth. To him, destiny lay in the stars, in the crystal spheres whose mathematical precision reflected universal laws laid down by the supreme God behind all things, the everlasting Aeon. Nor was Theon alone in these beliefs. In this uncertain age, it was not only the Christians, Jews, and pagan cults that looked to the supernatural for answers. In the museum itself, Theon could have met and probably knew well other occultists, such as Paulus of Alexandria and the anonymous writer now known to us simply as the Astrologer of the Year 379. It was against this background that the Christian patriarch Theophilus came to power in Alexandria in 385. In his eyes, the paganism of Theon and the members of the museum was not simply harmless hocus-pocus, but a threat, like any belief that deviated from the patriarch's orthodox views. The early bloody history of the Church and its hard-won agreement on what was orthodox and what was heresy had made it combative. The Christians of the Empire had often been persecuted for their beliefs, but now their moment in the sun had come. The Empire was Christian, and for Theophilus that could mean only the destruction of paganism altogether. In June 391, an opportunity came to do just that. The news reached Alexandria that the Emperor Theodosius had banned all pagan practices. The focus of Theophilus's attack would not be the museum itself, but the Serapeum, home to the ancient Ptolemaic cult of Serapis, and the location of the Daughter Library. As news of the edict of suppression spread, fear gripped the city's pagans. The prophetic Antoninus, son of Sosipatra, had already foretold the fall of the temple, and a group of pagans now fearfully barricaded themselves inside, under the unlikely command of a cabal of philosophers. These men were a cross-section of an ancient world on the verge of disappearing. They included Olympius, a servant of Serapis, the 700-year-old god of the Ptolemies who had been forged by the Greeks to help them rule a foreign land. Ammonius, a priest of the Egyptian god Thoth, whom the Alexandrians associated with the Greek god Hermes, but whose Egyptian roots lay in a religion older than the pyramids. Heladius, a priest of Ammon, the oracular god who had informed Alexander of his own divine origins at Siwa. The poet Palladas, known for his bitter epigrams written in the persona of a pagan schoolteacher forced to live in a Christian city. And finally, Claudian, whose icy poetry would one day find him favour in Rome as court poet. But these eclectic representatives of Alexandria's old guard were not there simply to await martyrs' deaths. They intended to go out fighting. From their stronghold, they organized repeated sorties against the Christian mob, picking fights where they could and dragging away any Christian foolish enough to approach the compound unprotected. So bitter had the enmity between these groups become that reports speak of them crucifying those they caught. It must have made for an extraordinary and terrifying sight as Theophilus's Christians and Olympius's pagans became caught up in the white-hot zealotry of a religious war. It seems almost impossible today to imagine poets and philosophers battling in the streets with monks and Christian converts, but both were battling not for ideas, but for beliefs, beliefs that both would die for. In the end, the pagans paid the highest price. The street battles dwindled into occasional skirmishes, and the pagans dug in inside the Serapeum had nowhere to go. When the running battle came to the attention of the Christian emperor, he ordered his representatives in Egypt, the Praefectus Augustalis, prefect, and the Dux Aegypti, military commander, to intervene. The pagans were ordered out of the Serapeum, and the Christian mob flooded in. Olympius and his compatriots had to watch as Bryaxis's 750-year-old statue of Serapis, a wonder of the world to many who had seen it, was dragged out into the street and smashed with a soldier's axe. No reports survive of what happened when the mob reached the Daughter Library, which Bishop Epiphanius of Salamis, who died in 402, claims in his Weights and Measures was still stored in the Serapeum. In fact, his is the only source which claims the library was still there. All other descriptions of the temple's sacking are silent on the issue, including even that of the vehemently anti-Christian Eunapius of Antioch, whom we might expect to put any thinkable atrocity at Theophilus's door. So in this moment, the fate of one of Alexandria's great libraries again slips through our fingers. It may be that the collection had already been moved, although, if so, we have no record of where it went. If it did remain in the Serapeum, then the centuries of writing kept in the pagan temple could only have raised suspicions. Whatever was contained in those scrolls belonged to the old world, the pagan world, and could have no place in the new Christian Alexandria. The early Christian writer Paulus Orosius, in his 7 Books of History Against the Pagans, does not mention specific temples, but seems to think the destruction of books kept within them was commonplace. Today there exist in temples book chests which we ourselves have seen, and when these temples were plundered, these, we are told, were emptied by our own men in our time, which indeed is a true statement. So we must presume that the Serapeum library was destroyed. One thing alone is certain. If it was kept there or elsewhere, the Daughter Library was never heard of again. Those philosophers who had actively fought to preserve the Serapeum now either fled, like Claudian, to Rome, or were deprived of their religious positions and state funding. Of the effect of the destruction on Alexandria and her pagan citizens, we have only the cold verses of Claudian and the bitter and rueful lines of Palladas's epigrams. in one of which he can't help but compare the vicissitudes of his life with the fate of the seafarers whom he must have watched come and go through the great harbour of his city every day. Life is a dangerous voyage, for, tempest-tossed in it, we often strike rocks more pitiably than shipwrecked men, and having chance as pilot of life, we sail doubtfully as on the sea, some on a fair voyage and others contrariwise. Yet all alike we put into the one anchorage under earth. Paladas. But not everyone had fought for or against Theophilus. Not every Neoplatonist had cast off his philosopher's robes to take up arms in the name of Serapis, Hermes, or paganism in general. Though Claudian had fled, and Paladas had sunk into a sea of despair, their loss had not left the lecture halls of Alexandria empty quite yet. Chapter 18. Hypatia. Revered Hypatia, ornament of learning, stainless star of wise teaching, when I see thee and thy discourse I worship thee, looking on the starry house of Virgo, for thy business is in heaven. Paladas, Greek Anthology. The highly charged religious atmosphere in Alexandria was making it a dangerous place to have an opinion, any opinion, and rough seas now buffeted what had once been the intellectual safe haven of the museum. Indeed, Theon is the last name we can definitely associate with the institution that has been at the centre of our story since the earliest days of the city. He is its last known member, the last in that roll call of the most brilliant names in antiquity. But it is his daughter who will always be associated with its fall. In the early years of the 5th century, Theon's daughter seemed to have emerged from the religious crisis of her father's era unscathed. From early childhood she had been her father's greatest collaborator, and we find her name first in his introduction to his commentary on the Almagest, commentary by Theon of Alexandria on Book 3 of Ptolemy's Almagest, edition revised by my daughter Hypatia the philosopher. Hypatia was the inheritor of her father's mantle. Indeed, many sources claim she was much more than that, and according to the philosopher Damascius, she was by nature more refined and talented than her father. She was a mathematician of noted brilliance, writing commentaries on the works of Apollonius of Perga and the notoriously complicated Arithmetica of the 3rd century inventor of algebra, Diophantus. Indeed, it has been doubted whether, without her clear, patient explanation of the works of this famously opaque mathematician, his work, crucial in the development of modern mathematics, would even have survived. The bitter irony is that today none of Hypatia's original works survive. And therein lies the key to one of Alexandria's most tragic episodes, the beginnings of its disappearance back into the Egyptian sands. Hypatia was born around 355 into the academic elite of Alexandria. At her father's side, she learned astronomy and mathematics, as well as the practical skills first mastered by such luminaries of the museum as Eratosthenes and Archimedes, including the building of planispheres and astrolabes. But her interests went far beyond the stars, into the realms of philosophy, a philosophy far removed from her father's mystical occultism. There is no evidence that Hypatia was ever herself a member of the museum, let alone the last librarian, as some have claimed. Indeed, after the death of her father, we have no evidence for the museum or library, in the sense that Archimedes or Euclid might have understood them, existing at all. According to the church father Epiphanius of Salamis, whose life roughly coincided with Hypatia's, he died in 403, the Bruchium quarter of the city, where this institution had once stood among gardens, royal palaces, and summer houses, now made for a rather startling sight. In describing the founding of the library, he makes the casual aside that it was in the part called the Bruchium. This is a quarter of the city today lying waste. We do not know which of the various Roman emperors left the most beautiful quarter of this city in ruins. It may be that this iconic part of the city had never recovered from the fury of Caracalla. But as Alexandria stands on a geological fault line that produced a major earthquake and subsequent tsunami in 365, we can't even be sure that it wasn't simply nature that tore down the marble halls. If the buildings of the old museum were gone, however, the idea of it was not dead, and the philosophy schools, now perhaps housed in the homes of the teachers, survived. From the late 380s, Hypatia had formed her own such school in the city, attracting the sons of some of the most influential and wealthy men in the empire. Among them she lectured in the subjects her father had taught her, ethics, ontology, astronomy, and mathematics. But to a smaller and more select group she also taught philosophy, including the ancient pagan ideas of Pythagoras, Plato, and Aristotle, as well as the Neoplatonism of Ammonius Saccas and Plotinus. This group of initiates became an intensely loyal family around Hypatia. They called each other brother, maintained their contacts over a lifetime, and would only hint to the outside world at what secrets they had heard in Hypatia's house. But this was not a crypto-pagan cult, not simply another band of disinherited priests reminiscing over the old days like the embittered Paladas. Nor were they the augurs and fortune-tellers that Theon counted among his friends. They instead represented both the old and the new in the empire and the city, and as such represented perhaps a chance for Alexandria to reinvent itself and so save itself one last time. The guarded nature of Hypatia's pupils and her own fate make it hard to unlock the secrets of her school. But thanks to the surviving letters of one of her closest followers, we can reconstruct something of her life and times and gain a window into a very unexpected world. Synesius of Cyrene was a young and wealthy landowner from Alexandria's sister city who came to Egypt's capital in the 390s to gain what even then must have been considered a classical education. In his 156 surviving letters, we gain tantalizing glimpses of the life of a 4th-century aristocrat in the city and at home. In a letter to his best friend Herculean, later prefect of Constantinople, he remembers their arrival in Alexandria and their time with Hypatia. The lady who presides over the mysteries of philosophy. If Homer had told us that it was an advantage to Odysseus in his wanderings that he saw the towns and became acquainted with the mind of many nations, and although the people whom he visited were not cultured, but merely Lystragonians and Cyclopses, how wondrously, then, would poetry have sung of our voyage, a voyage in which it was granted to you and me to experience marvellous things, the bare recital of which had seemed to us incredible. We have seen with our eyes, we have heard with our ears, the lady who legitimately presides over the mysteries of philosophy, Synesius. From his letters we also learn something of the other disciples in Hypatia's house, including Olympius, a hugely wealthy Syrian landowner with whom Synesius talked of hunting and horses, his little brother Euoptius, Ision, who told stories like no other, Cyrus, our friend, his uncle Alexander, Father Theotechnus, the worthy and holy, Theodosius, a grammarian of the first order, Auxentius, his childhood playmate, and Gaius, the most sympathetic. At one level these seem exactly what might be expected from an old aristocracy, young men looking to a heroic and already ancient past. Synesius talks about happy days on his estate outside Cyrene that reminded him of the Golden Age, and in Alexandria, gazing across the Heptar Stadion to the Pharos, and walking down the marble colonnades of the Street of the Soma, he must have imagined he walked with the ghosts of Alexander, Callimachus, and Archimedes. But Hypatia's family were not all they appeared. These were not, as they have so often been characterized by later writers, the last of the old guard. She was a pagan, true, or at least she was a Neoplatonist, but astonishingly, perhaps half of her students were Christians. Synesius himself married a Christian and went on to become Bishop of Ptolemais in Cyrenaica, where he was succeeded in that position by his little brother, the fervent Euoptius. The mysterious Petrus, mentioned in one letter, has a name which suggests his Christian pedigree as well, while Synesius's friend Herculean became Bishop of Cotium in western Turkey. This perhaps explains how, when others were barricading themselves in the Serapeum or fleeing abroad, Hypatia continued teaching unhindered. So just what was Hypatia teaching this eclectic inner circle who gathered at her house in the city in the last years of the 4th century and the first decade of the 5th? From Synesius we can discover that it must have been a form of Neoplatonic philosophy far removed from the radicalism of the defenders of the Serapeum, a gentler and older Hellenism that had bound all those who had worked in the library and museum, regardless of politics or creed. In a letter to Herculean, Synesius exhorts him to go on digging up the eye that is buried within us. And in that phrase we probably hear an echo of Hypatia's own words, as she taught her charges to release the luminous child of reason. It seems that what Hypatia wanted most from her students was that they love and seek wisdom, but not simply knowledge divorced from the real world around them. The course that she advocated required physical purity and mental wisdom. Learning was not of itself enough, nor was right living, as Synesius tells Herculean. The masses think that uprightness of life does not exist for the end of wisdom, but stands by itself, and is itself the perfection of man, and that the way is not a way merely, but the goal itself at which we must aim. In this view they are mistaken. An unreasoning self-control and an abstinence from eating of meat have been given to many unreasoning creatures by nature. We do not commend a raven or any other creature that has discovered a natural virtue because they are devoid of reasoning power. To live according to reason is the end of man. Synesius. Hypatia, at least in the minds of her followers, perfectly combined the two. She was a teacher who remained a virgin all her life, who always wore the simple white tribon robe of a philosopher, and who practiced moderation in everything. Those lucky enough to spend time with her referred to themselves as the fortunate chorus that delights in her divinely sweet voice, and called her Divine Spirit and Blessed Lady. Even in her ordinary lectures, her disciples seem to have found divine truths, learning that mathematics is a stepping stone to understanding and, as Synesius puts it, that astronomy is itself a divine form of knowledge. Her influence in Alexandria reached far beyond her private teaching circle. The chronicler Socrates Scholasticus tells us that she also gave public lectures where city officials and ordinary citizens might hear her, and says that she achieved such heights of erudition that she surpassed all the other philosophers of her day. He also claims that she succeeded to the Platonic school derived from Plotinus, although it is unclear if this means she was the official head of the Neoplatonic school, and delivered all the philosophical lectures to those who wished to listen. This public speaking spread her fame throughout the higher echelons of the government, and she seems to have been consulted at least informally by senior officials, including counsellors, military commanders, and even the prefect. Socrates Scholasticus tells us, on account of the majestic outspokenness at her command, as the result of her education, she maintained a dignified intercourse with the chief people of her city, for all esteemed her highly and admired her. Yet her teachings do not seem to have brought her into conflict with either the Christians among her group or the church authorities in the form of Alexandria's patriarch Theophilus. Indeed, Synesius writes to both Theophilus and the philosopher Hypatia asking for similar favours, as though the two were on a comparable level. That she avoided such trouble during Theophilus's anti-pagan campaigns tells us that her Hellenism was cultural rather than religious, centred on the raison d'etre of the museum, the pursuit of knowledge, and the self-knowledge that leads to understanding. The schools of Alexandria didn't yet separate pupils on religious grounds, so all religions could seek wisdom with Hypatia, a wisdom born not from dogma, magic, augury, or sacrifices, but from thought alone. But this understanding was not for everyone. Her group considered themselves an elite, as indeed they were, both in education and fortune, and the squabbles of believers, those who considered belief enough in itself, were, in their eyes, beneath them. Synesius himself rails against both the white mantles, the street philosophers peddling quick-fix paganism to the masses, and the black mantles, zealous monks preaching Christian salvation. For him and his teacher, divine knowledge was not for the masses, but reserved for the favoured few who could survive the arduous mental journey to enlightenment. For them, the path to truth, be it Neoplatonist truth or Christian truth, was an intellectual obstacle course whose end could be reached only by great mental effort, physical moderation, and ethical purity. Belief of itself would never be enough. The road still had to be travelled, and that journey was the subject of Hypatia's private classes, and the reason for the great secrecy that surrounded the discussions of their inner circle. Pogroms, fighting, and desecrations were for believers who took on an idea without thinking, but had nothing to do with them. It was an extraordinary concept, and one which could hold both pagans and Christians together. But just as it formed, so its hour was already passing. The patriarch Theophilus died on Tuesday, October the 15th, 412. He had spent his years in office antagonizing both pagans and Christian heretical sects, but had never touched Hypatia's circle. He had been known to the people of Alexandria as the Church Pharaoh, yet he had been careful not to overextend his power into the secular administration of the city, the preserve of the prefect and docks. Nor had he sought to interfere in the philosophical education of men such as Synesius, who he knew would one day take high office in his church. It had been a delicate balancing act, and Theophilus's death left a dangerous power vacuum. And into that vacuum exploded his nephew Cyril. Two candidates were nominated to succeed Theophilus, and the nature of the subsequent election campaign would give an unpleasant foretaste of what was to come. The stronger candidate was said to be Timothy, Theophilus's archdeacon, who had a lot of backing within the church hierarchy as well as the support of one of the military commanders in the city. The other was Cyril, Theophilus's nephew, an impetuous, self-promoting radical who believed in backing up the power of the word with the power of the mob. This was not to be an election decided by debate or even a vote. 3 days of street fighting ensued, after which, on October the 17th, a triumphant Cyril was installed as patriarch. This brutal election had been a testing ground for Cyril's influence, involving, as it did, secular imperial figures as well as church fathers. And from his victory Cyril drew some new and deadly lessons. Just as the state had become involved in an ecclesiastical struggle, although bearing in mind the violence of the struggle it had actually had little choice, so now, as patriarch, Cyril believed he had a right to a say in the secular administration of the city. This belief in a new, wider mandate would have terrible consequences, as Socrates Scholasticus says. Cyril came into possession of the episcopate, with greater power than Theophilus had ever exercised, for from that time the bishopric of Alexandria went beyond the limits of its sacerdotal functions and assumed the administration of secular matters. Socrates. Cyril wasted no time in suppressing any groups in the city that either disagreed with him or did not accept his absolute power over them. The first to suffer in his purification of the church was the entirely harmless Christian Novatian sect. The Novatians followed the teachings of the Roman priest Novatian, who had split from the official Catholic Church because he considered it too lax in readmitting former Christians who had, in the face of persecution, renounced their religion. His followers called themselves the Pure, and required considerably greater self-discipline among themselves than Cyril's followers did. Indeed, perhaps that is why he set upon them. Socrates Scholasticus certainly had some sympathy for Novatians, and notes, "Cyril immediately, therefore, shut up the churches of the Novatians at Alexandria and took possession of all their consecrated vessels and ornaments, and then stripped their bishop Theopemptus of all that he had." It seems that in Alexandria, at least, Cyril would have no bishop but himself. Next, he turned from those he considered too religious to those he considered not religious enough, the Jewish community. It had come to his notice that some Jews in the city did not celebrate the Sabbath in a particularly religious way, preferring instead to visit the theatres rather than staying at home in prayer. For Cyril, this presented an opportunity not just to confront the Jews, but to draw the state authorities into his arguments, and make them decide whose side they were on as well. Since his election campaign, Cyril had skillfully used the Christian mob in the city and groups of radical Nitrian monks from the desert to stir up trouble. He now stationed his people in the theatres to goad the Jewish population into taking violent action. On one of these occasions, the prefect of Egypt, Orestes, happened to be in the theatre giving a speech when a brawl broke out. Some of the Jews in the audience shouted out to Orestes that Hierax, an agent of Cyril, was fomenting trouble and begged for his arrest. Orestes, already aware of Cyril's attempts to extend his influence into the government of the city, was only too happy to oblige, and Hierax was arrested and tortured. But if he hoped to put Cyril in his place and remind him of the terrible powers of the prefect, he was very much mistaken. Cyril immediately summoned the Jewish leaders of the city as though he were governor himself, and warned them in the most patronizing terms to behave and leave his agents alone. It was the last straw of antagonism for some Jews in the audience, first goaded and threatened by Cyril's thugs, then sternly told off like children by their leader when they tried to fight back. At that moment, some decided to take physical action, and in doing so, played straight into Cyril's hands. The event that gave Cyril the opportunity he had been looking for occurred late one night. Having set an ambush around the Church of St. Alexander, a group of radicalized Jews ran through the streets, shouting that the church was on fire. Local Christians jumped from their beds and ran to the building to help, only to find they had run into a trap. A bloody fight ensued in which many of them were killed. Cyril now had his martyrs, and he rushed to surround the main synagogues with large crowds of his supporters, whom he only too easily whipped into a frenzy of retribution. Authorizing the looting of Jewish sites, he then ordered the expulsion of the entire Jewish population, who, as Socrates Scholasticus notes, had been there since the days of Alexander. Stripped of all their property and possessions, they were then cast out and dispersed, some in one direction and some in another. Cyril quickly wrote to the emperor to tell him of the outrageous behavior of the Jews and the necessity of the action he had taken. But it was a dangerously provocative move. As Socrates Scholasticus records, the Jewish population had been a vital part of the running of the city from its earliest days. This was the city of the Septuagint, the home of Philo, and the removal of this ancient population would have a profound economic as well as social impact on the functioning of the city. The prefect Orestes was, not surprisingly, incensed, and sent his own report to the emperor. If the emperor did respond, not one of the contemporary chroniclers records his judgment. In truth, it was a subject low on his list of priorities, a spat between two local officials, with just the sort of dangerous religious edge he wished to steer clear of. So the chroniclers probably failed to record the imperial verdict for a simple reason. None came. This was a problem Alexandrians would have to work out for themselves. In the face of the prefect's anger, Cyril seems to have made at least a tentative attempt at reconciliation, although his reported waving of the Gospels under Orestes' nose made it clear that any rapprochement would be on his terms, and his terms alone. But Cyril's provocation had now brought Orestes to the breaking point. Seeing his power eroding before him, the prefect decided finally to try to face Cyril down and rebuffed his overtures of peace. So Cyril turned back on his other tried and tested method of getting his own way. His call went out again to the radical Nitrian monks of the desert, and some 500 quit their monasteries and headed for the streets of Alexandria. There they came across Orestes riding in his chariot and surrounded him. Socrates tells us that they called him a pagan idolater, and applied to him many other abusive epithets. He, supposing this to be a snare laid for him by Cyril, exclaimed that he was a Christian, and had been baptized by Atticus, the bishop, at Constantinople. This was not enough for the monks, who were intent on action, not argument. One of their number, Ammonius, seized a rock and threw it at the prefect. It struck him on the head, and blood immediately began to pour down his face. In the ensuing panic, Orestes' own guards abandoned him, and it was only thanks to the intervention of other passers-by, the ordinary people of Alexandria, that he got away. The wounded prefect ordered the immediate arrest of Ammonius, who was caught and tortured to death. Two more letters were now dispatched to the emperor, one from Orestes decrying the patriarch's behavior, the other from Cyril, claiming Ammonius, or Thaumasius, the Wonderful, as he now called him, as a martyr. The emperor's response, once again, was silence, and Cyril and Orestes were left to resolve the problem alone. The race was now on to decide who would rule Alexandria, the state or the church, logic or belief. Only one could survive. First blood seemed to go to Orestes. Cyril had overstepped the mark and misread popular opinion. The response in Alexandria was not what he had hoped for, and the Christians did not take Saint Wonderful to their hearts. But the more sober-minded, although Christians, did not accept Cyril's prejudiced estimate of him, for they well knew that he had suffered the punishment due to his rashness, and that he had not lost his life under the torture because he would not deny Christ. And Cyril himself, being conscious of this, suffered the recollection of the circumstance to be gradually obliterated by silence. Socrates. So Saint Wonderful slipped from sight, his elevation among the realms of the martyrs proving only temporary. Cyril would need another way of getting to the prefect if he wanted to exert his power over the city as a whole, and, fatally for her, he would find it in the quiet person of Hypatia. Up to this point, Hypatia had been invisible in the record. Philosophically, she may well have felt that the squabbles of believers were unworthy of her consideration, but her regular contact with the authorities, and Orestes in particular, must have created within her a growing sense of dread. In this situation, it was simply not enough to ignore Cyril and his attempts on power. With his brand of Christianity, he intended to be the central core of the running of the city. His interpretation of religion was his politics, and by claiming to be executing the will of God, he gave himself carte blanche to act in any way he saw fit. This was undoubtedly a threat to the freedoms of the city Hypatia loved, and she could do little but throw her considerable influence behind the moderate Orestes. That Hypatia, who was now about 60, had been distancing herself from her circle, perhaps to protect them as the situation deteriorated, is clear from one of Synesius's last letters to her. In it he says, "If I could only have letters from you and learned how you were all faring, I am sure you are happy and enjoying good fortune, I should have been relieved in that case of half of my own trouble in rejoicing at your happiness. But now your silence has been added to the sum of my sorrows. I have lost my children, my friends, and the goodwill of everyone. The greatest loss of all, however, is the absence of your divine spirit. I had hoped that this would always remain to me, to conquer both the caprices of fortune and the evil turns of fate." Synesius. But there was little happiness or good fortune to be had in Alexandria. Hypatia's support for Orestes was a thorn in Cyril's side. One chronicler tells of how he stopped at her house one day and was overcome with jealousy when he saw the huge crowds clamouring to hear her speak. She was widely respected in the city, had close connections with the council and government, and counted among her friends and pupils some of the most important people in the empire, including men at the imperial court. But she did have a weakness. Orestes was a moderate Christian, as had been many of Hypatia's school, but Hypatia herself was apparently not a Christian at all. She was of the old Alexandria, the last of the Hellenes. This was the wedge that Cyril now drove between prefect and philosopher. Cyril circulated a rumour that she was a practitioner of black magic, a sorceress who was devoted at all times to magic, astrolabes, and instruments of music. To the city mob, who had little to do with the museum or library, it must have had a certain ring of truth. What did go on in her secret meetings with her inner circle? Had her father not been an astrologer and alchemist? Even the tools of science she had learned to make at her father's knee could be turned against her. Astrolabes, hydroscopes, and the like were not simply scientific tools, they were also regularly used for divination among the superstitious Alexandrians. So Cyril ensured that the slander spread, that it was Hypatia who stood between him and Orestes, two good Christians, and she who was trying to undermine the religion and well-being of the state. It was, of course, a lie, but a powerful one, and one which took deep root among Cyril's most fervent supporters, the Parabolans. The job of the Parabolans was, in theory at least, to help ill and destitute Christians in the city to find a place in hospitals or almshouses, but under recent patriarchs they had become almost a private army. These poorly educated but fervently religious young men obeyed the patriarch without question, and were only too happy to put their imposing presence, there were 800 of them, and any degree of force necessary behind his commands. It was this group, no doubt encouraged by Cyril, who now decided to take direct action against Hypatia. Fired with hatred, this band was led by a man called Peter, a lector in the church whom the Christian chronicler John of Nicaea called a perfect believer in all respects in Jesus Christ. And under his command, the Parabolans now began searching the city for Hypatia. She was not hard to find, regularly riding in her chariot through the streets, very much living her life in public. They came across her as she was heading home, outside the Caesareum, the temple built for Mark Antony by Cleopatra shortly before their deaths, and since converted into a Christian church. There, by the three obelisks known as Cleopatra's Needles, they surrounded her and dragged her from her chariot. In the street, this most modest of women had her tribon torn from her and was stripped naked. But even her Parabolan attackers did not have the nerve to execute the next part of their plan in full public view. Dragging her inside the church, they threw her on the floor of the nave and, in the sort of rage that only blind zealotry brings, set upon her with broken pieces of roof tile, flaying her alive. Her torn and mutilated body was then carried beyond the walls to a place called Kinneron, where her remains were burned on a bonfire. A witch's death. No one is recorded as having come to her aid. The last of the Alexandrian Hellenes was gone. Cyril now had to work quickly to ensure that the blame for this horrific act did not fall directly on him, but he can only have been delighted at the outcome. Orestes now disappears from the historical record, either having been recalled by the emperor or simply having fled. Some Alexandrian counsellors did attempt to intervene with the emperor, but Cyril's friends at court ensured that the affair was hushed up, and the only response was a mild attempt to reorganize and reduce the numbers of Parabolans, taking their recruitment away from Cyril and resting it with the prefect. Even that did not last long, and by 418, Cyril had that power back as well. Cyril carefully portrayed the death of Hypatia as a fight between Christians and pagans, distancing himself in the process from the real cause of the tension, his attempt to seize power from a Christian prefect. John of Nicaea sums up perfectly how Cyril wished the story to be told. All the people surrendered to the patriarch Cyril and named him the new Theophilus, for he destroyed the last remains of idolatry in the city. Socrates Scholasticus, himself a revered historian of the early church, took a more sober view. This affair brought not the least opprobrium not only upon Cyril, but also upon the whole Alexandrian church. And surely nothing can be farther from the spirit of Christianity than the allowance of massacres, fights, and transactions of that sort. But Cyril had won, and now settled down to live out his patriarchy more quietly. He died in June 444, after an episcopate of nearly 32 years. He would later be remembered as a doctor of the church, and be raised to sainthood. Chapter 19. The Shipwreck of Time. Come and see my shining palace, built upon the sand. Edna St. Vincent Millay. A Few Figs from Thistles. With the death of Hypatia, her city also began to die. Philosophers were still to be found in the city's streets, and the Alexandrian school continued quietly, ever more quietly, to refine pagan Neoplatonism. Plato, Aristotle, and Plotinus were still read and talked of, but in truth, the whole complexion of the city had changed. In the streets, violent religious extremism and an associated rise in ethnic tensions were fanning the flames of nationalism. Customs were changing, shunning the foreign Greek influence of Hypatia's Hellenism, despite the fact it had been the cornerstone, indeed the very raison d'etre, of the city. Even the language was slowly transforming. Still written in a Greek alphabet, but with the addition of 6 hieroglyphic characters, its structure now more influenced by ancient Egyptian. This new hybrid language would eventually emerge as Coptic, the language of the Christians of Egypt. After Theon, we no longer hear of the work of the museum, if indeed it survived the anti-pagan policies of the emperors and patriarchs. It was, after all, a temple to the muses, and as such, ripe for suppression. As mystical religion had taken hold of the city, as control of the government had slipped from Alexandrian to Roman hands, so the whole nature of academic life in the city had slowly been changing. Academics were now obsessed with compiling and editing older works, not creating new thoughts and new books. The creators had been replaced by the codifiers and critics, who, in the manner of their theological counterparts who pored over the holy books in which they said all answers lay, searched for truth in old ideas, rather than seeking out new ones. The spirit of adventure had left the halls of the museum, The minds which once reached beyond its colonnades to the ends of the earth and beyond, far into space, were gone. And what of the books? The fate of the libraries of Alexandria is one of the greatest mysteries of the ancient world. It would still be tragic, but at least convenient, if a single moment for their destruction could be found, a moment at which the curtain came down on the classical world and a new and darker age commenced. But it is not that simple. We know from the scholarly references which fill Synesius's letters that he gained access to a large number of classical texts during his time in Alexandria, although he probably did not get these from one great central library. That institution had died, not with a bang, but a whimper. It may well be that the majority of the ancient collection of the Ptolemies was destroyed when Julius Caesar burned the Egyptian fleet in the great harbour, and the flames carried over the roofs of the old city. Livy tells us there were 400,000 scrolls in the collection at that time, and their loss might have inspired Mark Antony to present the library of Pergamum to Cleopatra as a lover's gift. Of course, books were still created and collected after this date, although they may have been stored separately in either a library attached directly to the museum or in the daughter library in the Serapeum. It was perhaps from those shelves that Synesius took the works of Homer and Plato, from which he so often quoted. But other books were probably even then missing, even then forgotten. Were Varro's 42 lost books of antiquities still there? Were the lost decades of Livy's Roman history still rolled up with the books that survive to this day? Very possibly not. The ravages of the fire of 48 BC, the literary pretensions and furious retributions of Roman emperors, and a simple dimming of the spark that had inspired the early Ptolemies to collect every book they could find, had all taken their toll. There were already empty shelves in the libraries that Hypatia and her followers knew, and perhaps only a dim memory preserved in Callimachus's lists of what treasures they once held. But it had been in Hypatia's own era that some of the final nails in Alexandria's coffin were driven home. Emperor Theodosius's order to shut all pagan temples in 391 had a profound effect upon learning in the city, not because Christianity opposed learning, Hypatia's own circle proved the opposite, but because its more extreme proponents equated pre-Christian learning with paganism. The Serapeum had been created by the Ptolemies specifically to appeal to Egyptians, and had been designed on an ancient Egyptian model as not just a temple, but a library and college. It was the logical home for the daughter library, but in finding a home in a pagan building, the books themselves became tarred with a brush of paganism. Knowledge has always been the enemy of extremism, and for the most radical elements among Alexandria's Christians, the books in the Serapeum were a threat, so they simply destroyed them. If any books survived by this date in any great library in the city, they too can only have come under suspicion. The museum, like all schools of the Greek model, like Plato's Academy and Aristotle's Lyceum, was at least nominally a religious institution. Only by centering his academy on a temple had Plato gained for it the protection of the city of Athens. It was simply how these things had always been done. But the idea of a temple to the pagan muses in Alexandria, in Christian Alexandria, could not have sat well with the Parabolans or the Nitrian monks who so readily chose to impose their will by force of arms, rather than by force of argument. In the aftermath of Hypatia's death, much of whatever was left of the great bookstores of antiquity must have gone. From now on, those who wished to read non-Christian texts probably did so in secret, collecting their own small libraries in the privacy of their houses. Cyril's Alexandria had no reason to spend civic or church funds on collecting old and idolatrous tomes. So Alexandria stumbled on, now shorn of its unique attribute. Even Patriarch Cyril was aware that the city he had fought so hard to possess was now the sickly little brother to the new Rome of Constantinople, whose influence spread far beyond his city's limited sphere. Perhaps aware that the city he had cut loose from its classical past was not now free but simply adrift, he did make one final bid to achieve his dream and make Alexandria the center of the new world, the Christian world. Using his tried and tested technique of accusation and confrontation, he charged Nestorius, the Patriarch of Constantinople, with heresy, and succeeded in having him expelled. But it was far too late for Cyril to take his place, or for Alexandria to become a new Constantinople. Learning in the city was dying. The monuments of previous ages had been looted, and her books, her precious books, were gone. Some up in flames, a few spirited away. Yet ironically, Cyril's last desperate move did save some small part of Alexandria. Of the few books that had survived from the great library, some had recently reappeared in Constantinople, and these were taken east by the banished Nestorius and his followers, out of the reach of the book burners and into the Syrian desert, where they were once again lost to Western scholarship. By the 7th century, Alexandria had become an anomaly, a rebellious Christian outpost on the coast of North Africa. The Brucheum and Jewish quarters were long abandoned, and the museum and the tomb of Alexander lay in ruins. Christian communities clustered around the Caesareum and Serapeum, both of whom had now become churches, and only the Heptastadion and the area around the Pharos remained densely populated. In 616, the city fell briefly to the Persian Emperor Khosrau II, only to be regained a decade later by the Romans. But by this date a new force was already heading her way, and was soon to overtake her. The emperors had taken little notice of the unification of the peoples of the Arabian Peninsula under the prophet Muhammad. The history of the patriarchs of Alexandria records an almost certainly apocryphal but telling story of how Emperor Heraclius failed to see the signs. And in those days Heraclius saw a dream in which it was said to him, "Verily there shall come against you a circumcised nation, and they shall vanquish you and take possession of the land." Perhaps not surprisingly, Heraclius thought this must be a reference to the Jews, and so ordered that all the long-suffering Jews and Samaritans in his empire were to be rounded up and compulsorily baptized. He soon realized, however, that he had made a mistake. But after a few days there appeared a man of the Arabs from the southern districts, that is to say, from Mecca or its neighborhood, whose name was Muhammad. Under the prophet Muhammad, the Arab world was uniting in a way it had never done before, and if the Roman world was unaware of it, it was not unaware of the Roman world. Under Muhammad's successors, the caliphs, this new nation was already vigorously expanding through a program of military conquests across the Near East. In 639, Omar I ordered his general Amr ibn al-Asi, better known as simply Amr, west, to conquer in the name of Islam. Damascus, Syria, and Jordan had already fallen, and Egypt would be next. Amr conquered Egypt with just 4,000 cavalry. The Byzantine viceroy Cyrus, who was also Patriarch of Alexandria, was found hiding in the citadel of Babylon, a Roman fortress in Cairo, and rapidly offered his country's capitulation. John of Nikiu tells us that Amr congratulated him on coming forward. Cyrus replied, "God has delivered this land into your hands. Let there be no enmity from henceforth between you and Rome. Heretofore there has been no persistent strife with you." Cyrus was putting a brave face on a rather unequal situation. Amr would certainly agree to peace, but it would be entirely on his terms. First a tribute in gold was to be paid, and then the Roman garrison in Alexandria was to be disbanded, although the troops were allowed to leave with their possessions and treasure intact. The Romans would promise no further military intervention in Egypt, and Amr would take 150 soldiers and 50 civilians as hostages to ensure they kept to the deal. The final part of the peace was more even-handed, and perhaps offered a last chance for peace in Alexandria. John of Nikiu summed up the deal succinctly. The Romans were to cease warring against the Muslims, and the Muslims were to stop seizing Christian churches and interfering in Christian religious practice. Sadly, this was not a peace that would last. The caliph's forces did not immediately take Alexandria, partly because the Arabs chose to avoid the place. In their eyes it was dangerous and corrupt, an ancient town of evil fortune filled with philosophers and monks, and the notoriously truculent city mob. By the time Amr did arrive in the city in September 642, the garrison was gone and there was little resistance as his cavalry rode in through the Gate of the Sun. The city he found still impressed him with its ancient temples converted into churches and the still dazzling marble of the colonnades on the main streets, and he seems to have treated its people with the respect he had promised. Those who wished to leave were allowed to, while those who wished to remain were permitted to continue worshipping in their churches unmolested, provided, of course, that they paid the appropriate tribute. Now, as master of all Egypt, Amr could write to the Caliph, telling him he had seized a city of 4,000 palaces, 4,000 baths, 12,000 dealers in fresh oil, 12,000 gardeners, 40,000 Jews who paid tribute, and 400 theatres or places of amusement. The Caliph seemed unimpressed, perhaps wary of the somewhat inflated figures from his general. He reportedly just nodded nonchalantly at the messenger and rewarded him with a loaf of bread, a bottle of olive oil, and a handful of dates. Perhaps Caliph Omar was right to be cautious, for the people of Alexandria did not keep to their side of the bargain. The Muslim writer Al-Barathuri, in his Conquest of Alexandria, recorded that the Alexandrians wrote to Emperor Constantine, the son of Heraclius, explaining how his subjects were humiliated by the Muslims and forced to pay a poll tax, effectively making them second-class citizens. They then casually added that the Muslim garrison was rather under strength, and hence vulnerable. Constantine, roused to righteous indignation, immediately took advantage of the situation and sent an expeditionary force to recapture the city for the empire. Constantine sent one of his men, called Manuel, with 300 ships full of fighters. Manuel entered Alexandria and killed all the guard that was in it, with the exception of a few who by the use of subtle means took to flight and escaped. When Amr returned to this situation around 646, he was no longer in a mood to deal generously with the inhabitants, nor were they foolish enough to think he would. Ancient Alexandria was about to fight its final battle. Al-Baladhuri finishes the tale. Amr made a heavy assault, set the ballisti, and destroyed the walls of the city. He pressed the fight so hard until he entered the city by assault, killed the fathers, and carried away the children as captives. Some of its Greek inhabitants left to join the Greeks somewhere else, and Allah's enemy, Manuel, was killed. Amr and the Muslims destroyed the wall of Alexandria in pursuance of a vow that Amr had made to that effect, in case he reduced the city. Amr ibn al-Asi conquered Alexandria. Al-Baladhuri, The Origins of the Islamic State. The city had become a minor irritant in the Muslims' conquest of Egypt, and its repeated calls on the Byzantine Empire for military help created unwanted friction. The solution of the Muslim general charged with bringing the city back to heel was simple. He tore it down. Flour once again flowed in the sands around the islands of Pharos, as the city's famous granaries were demolished. It is at this point, with Amr back in control of the city's remains, that the final legend associated with the Great Library is set. The story comes from a much later source, Bar Hibrius's History of the Dynasties, written in the 13th century, and is almost certainly fictional. But it does prove that the fame of the library and the need to explain its terrible loss was still felt centuries after it had vanished. Bar Hibrius tells the story that John the Grammarian, a Coptic priest present at the destruction of the city, was, due to his great learning, on good terms with Amr, and eventually plucked up the courage to ask him about the fate of the library. "You have examined the whole city. You have set your seal on every kind of valuable. I make no claim for aught that is useful to you, but things useless to you may be of service to us." "What are you thinking of?" said Amr. "The books of wisdom," said John, "which are in the imperial treasuries." He then patiently described how the Ptolemies had collected books on all subjects from the four corners of the world, regardless of expense, and then rather extraordinarily claimed that they still existed in the warehouses of the city which Amr had sealed following his victory. While the city was now Amr's to do with as he pleased, would he not consider leaving intact this rare collection, as it could be of no use to either him or his soldiers? Amr, renowned for his own scholarship, declared himself amazed at this news, but warned that it was not in his power to hand such a library over to John. However, he would write to the Caliph and seek his advice on the matter. In time the Caliph wrote back with bad news. "Touching the books you mention, if what is written in them agrees with the Book of God, they are not required. If it disagrees, they are not desired. Destroy them, therefore." So Amr, faithful to his master's decision, ordered the books distributed among the bath houses of the city. where they provided fuel for the boilers for 6 months. "Listen and wonder," concluded Bar Hebreus. The origin of this story is uncertain, and it occurs in none of the earlier chronicles. By the 13th century, however, not long after the disastrous failure of the Third Crusade against Saladin, it suited a Christian writer like Bar Hebreus and his audience to characterize the Muslim world as barbaric and backward. And even if the enemy was wrong, there was a ring of truth to the idea that religious bigotry had, after 1,000 years of enlightenment, finally dragged Alexandria into oblivion. Ironically, however, it was Muslim scholars who were even then preserving and translating the few great works from Alexandria's library shelves that had survived. What the story does powerfully demonstrate is that any conqueror might consider the contents of a library as dangerous as the contents of an arsenal. Building that arsenal of ideas had been a driving force behind Ptolemy I's creation of Alexandria, and the insecurity of conquerors and the intolerance of extremists had been its downfall. Alexandria had been a city of ideas, where the greatest freedom was the freedom to think. But Roman emperors, Christian patriarchs, and Muslim caliphs had all, in attempting to control those thoughts, whittled away at the library, the city, and the idea that lay behind them. 1,000 years after the walls of Alexandria fell, the traveller George Sands reached her sad remains and wrote her epitaph. "Queen of cities and metropolis of Africa, who now hath nothing left but her ruins and those ill witnesses of her perished beauties, declaring that towns as well as men have their ages and destinies." George Sands, The Relation of a Journey Begun Anno Domini. Epilogue. A distant shore. I picked up a bottle half buried in the wet sand, covered with barnacles, but stoppled tight, and half full of red ale, which still smacked of juniper. All that remained, I fancied, from the wreck of a rowdy world. That great salt sea on the one hand, and this little sea of ale on the other, preserving their separate characters. What if it could tell us its adventures over countless ocean waves? Man could not be man through such ordeals as it had passed. But as I poured it slowly out onto the sand, it seemed to me that man himself was like a half-emptied bottle of pale ale, which time had drunk so far, yet stoppled tight for a while, and drifting about in the ocean of circumstances, but destined ere long to mingle with the surrounding waves, or be spilled amid the sands of a distant shore. Henry David Thoreau, Cape Cod. As the monk Maximus Planudes lifted the copy of Ptolemy's Geographia from the tomes piled around the book dealer's stall in Constantinople that day back in 1294, one piece of the wreckage of Alexandria began a new journey. Planudes had turned the ancient words into maps, which were added to and improved on by the Byzantine court. One of these had itself found its way from the edges of Asia to a wealthy Florentine with the time and money to translate its Greek text back into the Latin that the scholars of Europe still understood. From Florence, that map found its way to Rome, to the apostolic library of the Pope, then the most powerful man on earth. And from there copies made their way across Europe, to the palaces and castles of the princes of Christendom. One of those would reach the Portuguese capital Lisbon, where in 1484 a young explorer named Christopher Columbus was, like Ptolemy before him, beginning to think the unthinkable. What if the world was indeed a sphere? What if he could sail west to Cathay? What if the book he held in his hands that day was correct, a book called The Geographia by Claudius Ptolemy? A book from the library at Alexandria. This concludes The Rise and Fall of Alexandria. Please visit our website, www.tantor.com, for more information on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks and to take advantage of special offers. Or call toll-free 877-7-TANTOR to request a catalogue.